Yeah, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting in the Israeli capital Tel Aviv. Two Palestinian gunmen opened fire late Wednesday on shoppers and diners in a marketplace near the Israeli Defense Ministry, killing four, wounding five. Ethan Ovid was a witness to the attack.
I have a meeting, a business meeting here. When I listen to shooting of a machine gun, not a gun, and I am in my past fight, I was in parachute, I running inside to the noise that I listen, and I find two wounded on the market, the restaurant.
Israeli police have both shooters in custody. One was wounded. They identify the two as cousins from the West Bank town Hebron. An Israeli police spokesman said an investigation is underway. There's been no attack on Israeli civilians and police in Tel Aviv since New Year's Day. No concrete intelligence a terror strike was in the works. Israel has seen a relative lull following 9 months of Palestinian attacks on Israelis, sparked by rumors that Israel was planning to take over an East Jerusalem religious site sacred to Muslims and Jews. A Nigerian rebel group has rejected the government's offer of talks to end pipeline attacks, disrupting the country's oil production. The Niger Delta Avengers said the group blew up an oil well belonging to the Chevron Corporation in the Warri North area. The Avengers have claimed responsibility for a wave of attacks in southern Nigeria on facilities owned by Chevron, Shell, and Eni. Analysts say the damage cut Nigerian oil output by at least 25%, more than half a billion barrels a day. The government said this week it was forming a committee to open talks with rebels. The previous wave of attacks in the south ended in 2009. This is VOA News. In Syria, a U.S.-backed alliance of Arab and Kurdish fighters is preparing to enter the Islamic State-held city of Manbij. U.S. Defense spokesman Colonel Christopher Garver said the Syrian Democratic Forces, numbering some 3,000, are on the outskirts of the town, and an assault is likely just days away.
Not a matter of hours. I think they're a matter of days out. At the pace they're moving now and at the speed that they've been able to fight the enemy, we think they're a matter of days before they conduct the attack on the city. That being said, the enemy gets a vote, and if Daesh puts up a stiffer resistance, that could slow down just in any type of normal fighting. But we think they're not hours out. We think they're days out. And we anticipate that assault to come in the coming days.
The campaign's success would cut off the IS group from recruits and fighters flowing in from Turkey. Meanwhile, airstrikes believed carried out by Syria struck rebel-held districts of the northern city Aleppo Wednesday, killing 15 civilians, damaging at least one hospital. Iraqi security forces have retaken a southern neighborhood in Fallujah from Islamic State fighters, the government's first presence in the western city in more than 2 years. A U.S. defense spokesman in Baghdad said brigades from three army divisions, counterterrorism units, federal police, and travel fighters are pushing toward this city's center. Meanwhile, there are signs the number of civilians trapped inside is much larger than first thought. Lisa Grand is the U.N. humanitarian coordinator for Iraq.
I think we thought that there would be about 40,000 to 50,000 civilians who were at grave risk. What we now think, based on the stories that people are telling us, is that there are probably closer to 90,000 civilians that are still inside of Fallujah, that are still trapped, that still can't reach safety.
The Pentagon spokesman said the fate of civilians in Fallujah is a tough problem and being watched closely. A suicide bomber detonated a car bomb outside of police headquarters near Turkey's border with Syria Wednesday, killing at least five people, the second such deadly blast in Turkey this week. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, addressing a joint meeting of Congress Wednesday in Washington, called for closer security cooperation in the fight against terrorism.
The fight against terrorism has to be fought at many levels, and the traditional tools of military intelligence our diplomacy alone would not be able to win this fight.
The Prime Minister praised the U.S. effort to achieve a stable democratic Afghanistan and underscored the growing economic and cultural ties between the two countries. Forces loyal to Libya's new unity government claim to have advanced deep inside the coastal city of Sirte, considered the Islamic State's stronghold in the North African country. A brigadier general told the Associated Press his forces seized a key bridge inside the city, only 5 kilometers from the city's center. The British government Wednesday said it would extend the period of voter registration for the European Union referendum by 48 hours to meet a last-minute surge in applications that crashed the voter registration website. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Abate in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch calls for accountability for war crimes committed in South Sudan's civil war.
The article drafted by Riek Machar and Salva Kiir really represents a self-serving effort to escape accountability.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Meanwhile, the people of South Sudan also say they want justice. The IMF calls on Guinea-Bissau's government to unwind the bailout of two private banks. And UNICEF says Burundi children belong in school, not in jail.
We have got reliable sources which report that other children of these schools took to the streets to protest the arrest of their classmates. And during these protests, two children were injured by gunshots.
Christoph Bulierak is spokesman for UNICEF. Some Zimbabwe ruling ZANU-PF party youth want President Robert Mugabe to rule until his death. And digging up the hidden gems of Africa's funk music era. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch organization is calling on the African Union to go ahead and set up the hybrid court that was part of the August 2015 South Sudan peace agreement to try alleged war crime suspects. Elise Kepler, Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, says setting up the court would prove that the African Union is committed to rejecting impunity in South Sudan. This comes as South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his first Vice President Riek Machar have written a joint opinion article in Tuesday's New York Times newspaper appealing to the world to support a Truth and Reconciliation Commission similar to that of South Africa as opposed to a court. They argue that punitive action would destabilize South Sudan. Kepler says the New York Times article is all an attempt by President Kiir and Machar to avoid the reach of the law.
The article drafted by Riek Machar and Salva Kiir really represents a self-serving effort to escape accountability. These leaders themselves are implicated in horrific crimes committed in South Sudan. They themselves agreed as part of a peace agreement to have justice advanced, and they took to the pages of the New York Times to attempt to sidestep the justice issue, pushing instead a proposal for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
As they said in the article, bringing South Sudan together, they say, can be truly guaranteed only through one route, which is an organized peace and reconciliation process.
Meanwhile, experience shows that that claim is untrue and outdated. Human Rights Watch, working for the past 20 years in a range of conflict situations, has found that impunity, lack of justice, regularly fuels more abuses. By contrast, having fair criminal trials promotes respect for rule of law, signals that these kinds of crimes will not be tolerated, and brings redress for victims.
But, Elise, if this sort of thing worked in South Africa, why can't it work in South Sudan?
At the time that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was created in South Africa, it was really a different era. The Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals had not been fully operational. You didn't have an international criminal court. There were certain realities that justice really had never been advanced in, 40 years around the globe for the worst atrocities. What's come to pass is that justice is now possible, and it's guaranteed not only under international law, but also in terms of principle for victims and rejecting impunity. What's important here is that the African Union itself has committed to reject impunity, and it has the responsibility to create a hybrid war crimes court for South Sudan.
Elise, just as I'm speaking with you, I've received a text from Juba, and this is from James Gadet, the SPLM-IO office. It says there that the article published by New York Times alleging that First Vice President, His Excellency Dr. Riek Machar, had agreed with President Salva Kiir to avoid justice or trials for those responsible for the atrocities committed in the war is not true. Somebody must have written it without the knowledge and agreement of the SPLM-IO leadership.
You know, to the extent that this comes forward as it being true that Machar was not actually involved with this piece, the better, because Machar and Kiir should be behind the idea of breaking what's been this cycle of violence and impunity and moving ahead with justice.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from New York City. Meanwhile, some South Sudanese agreed with Human Rights Watch that their leaders, especially those who committed crimes against humanity during the country's civil war, must be accountable, as we hear in this Vox part from Juba.
For this country to go back and it's normal, there must be accountability. And especially those who have been involved in all those atrocities must be held accountable and be brought before the justice and let them answer, you know, for the atrocities that they have committed.
The major people who are supposed to be held accountable, the commanders who were in the front line, they are really responsible because they are the one who influence the local communities to go and attack their fellow members.
To me, the way I see my opinion is the person or the group or an organization which is to be held accountable in this atrocity would be after maybe the results of the Truth Commission which is formed and they have areas to work in. So I think out of that we can get who should be held responsible, and the person who should be held responsible should be exposed to the people to know that who was behind the atrocity for the last 2 years.
I don't think there are specific people who are supposed to be held responsible or accountable for what happened. Basically, I think some of the international people knows of who and who was involved into this kind of conflict. So they can be put into trials so they can either be proved guilty or innocent.
The concerned personnel who should be taken to the court, these are the two commander-in-chief. They should be taken and they should specify exactly those commanders in the bush who were responsible for this.
The report was very clear that both parties committed crimes and both parties committed the war crimes. So for those who are to be held accountable, I normally say that both parties to the war, all those who participated in the war, and all those who committed the crimes, all the war crimes, both of them have to be brought to books and both of them have to be tried equally.
I think the perpetrators should account. We need to try the people and they should be convicted so that there's an element of accountability.
The voices of some South Sudanese as they reacted to an article in the New York Times newspaper purportedly written by President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar. Authorities in Burundi arrested 11 students last week for defacing a photo of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Hundreds more were suspended from two other schools on similar charges. The United Nations Children's Fund says it is concerned with the situation and is calling on Burundian authorities to respect the students' right to education. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Burundi has undergone more than a year of turmoil since President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to run for a third term, which his critics said was unconstitutional. Violence since then has killed an estimated 500 people and prompted more than a quarter million to flee the country. Now the tension appears to be spilling into the country's high schools. Last week, 11 students in the central province of Muramvya were arrested for allegedly writing derogatory remarks on a photo of the president in a textbook. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says the students who attend three different schools were held for questioning. He tells VOA that other students have reacted angrily to the government's heavy-handed action.
Now, we have got reliable sources which report that other children of these schools took to the streets to protest the arrest of their classmates. And during these protests, two children were injured by gunshots. And one of these children is still receiving care.
As of Wednesday, five of the arrested students remain in jail, while six under the age of 18 were temporarily freed by a judge on Tuesday. More than 330 students at two schools near the capital, Bujumbura, were suspended for similar activities the last week in May. Those students have been invited to return, but many have not gone back. UNICEF says details surrounding these alarming events are murky, but on all accounts, it says such action against children trying to pursue an education is totally unacceptable. Bouyrak says UNICEF is on the ground with other aid workers following up on the cases of the children who have been arrested and injured. The agency says these disturbing incidents are only the latest in which children in Burundi have been victimized since the outbreak of political violence in April 2015. Since then, it reports 30 children have been killed and more than 300 arbitrarily arrested. It says many of these children have been imprisoned with adults, often in squalid conditions with little food and water. UNICEF says it has assisted in the release from detention of 134 children who had been arbitrarily arrested on so-called crisis-related charges. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 9th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, recently announced it will withhold payments to Guinea-Bissau after the government refused to heed IMF advice and went ahead to bail out two private banks. Oscar Mejado, the IMF country representative to Guinea-Bissau, tells Ricky Stryak that the IMF ultimately wants the country to unwind the private bank bailouts so that the government does not bear a fiscal cost.
The costly bank bailouts benefit the wealthiest people in the country and come at the expense of urgently needed projects to improve the infrastructure and to reduce poverty. In addition, the bailouts lack transparency and raise serious governance concerns as 100% of commercial risks related to the non-performing loans were shifted from the private sector to the government. The IMF provided technical assistance in early 2015, and our advice was clear then not to have the bailouts.
What do you say to the Bissau government's reaction that the bailouts were needed to save the private sector? I mean, is that true or is that... It's not as simple as that.
It's not as simple as that because like 50% of the loans did not have guarantee. And the deal that was done is basically the government is bearing all the cost and the risk. Certainly there were some private sector individuals that could have been helped with that, but if they negotiate directly with the banks with no government involvement.
And what is the current IMF payment program?
The main disbursement was about $11 million. This is what is going to be disbursed this year. And this is important because it goes to budgetary support. And also, depending on us, other donors will disburse as well. And for the time being, this has been delayed. We haven't cut the program. It's only the disbursements are delayed. If the government takes the right actions, we can restore the disbursements.
What are those actions, and how hard is it for the government to take those actions, considering there basically is no working government at this point, since Bissau is in a very deep political crisis?
The option is to unwind the bailouts, so the government doesn't bear a fiscal cost. That will be the optimal solution.
What do you mean unwind? Take the money back or stop giving them the money? How does that work?
That the loans, non-performing loans, return to the banks.
That was Oscar Mejado, International Monetary Fund's representative to Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the capital, Bissau. Some ZANU-PF youth in Zimbabwe's Manicaland province say they want President Robert Mugabe to rule until he dies. Their remarks come at a time when some war veterans recently endorsed Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa as President Mugabe's heir apparent. Loy Moyo of the U.S. Zimbabwe Program reports.
Mobuso Chinguno, chairperson of the ruling party's Provincial Youth League, described the war veterans' move as treasonous, stressing that no one should be declared President Mugabe's successor until he dies. He said there is currently no vacancy in the presidium, adding that they expect the president to die in office like his late deputies Joshua Nkomo, Simon Mzenda, Joseph Msika, and John Nkomo.
First and foremost, Msangano wezanu PF takawirirana isusu kuti vamugabe ndo president ndo first secretary wezanu PF.
We in the Zanu PF party agreed from the onset that Comrade Mugabe is our first secretary, president, and also our candidate come 2018 elections. So the talk of endorsing people that is happening is being rebellious. It's the same as organizing a coup.
But ex-combatant Ivan Mbengo and a member of the Manicaland Provincial Executive of the former Freedom Fighters say the decision to have Mr. Mugabe rule to his grave cannot be made by a small group of ZANU-PF youth. Mbengo said such a decision should be broad-based and can be reached through a national referendum.
The best way always is to go through a democratic election within the party and within the country.
Lloyd Munguma, a political activist based in Manicaland province, described as misguided the ZANU-PF youth's suggestions that Mr. Mugabe should rule until he dies.
I think that is unacceptable and that is totally nonsensical, because first, as youth, we are fighting for democracy in Zimbabwe, where we are saying as youth we are the future leaders of this country. So I find it really absurd for one to claim that Comrade Robert Mugabe must die in office.
MDCT Manicaland Provincial Spokesperson and the Mutasa Central member of the National Assembly, Trevor Sarwaka, said such a call from the ruling party youth is regrettable.
I think that's a shame for the young generation to make such a statement. But as far as we are aware, President Mugabe has run his race. He's now a liability to this country. Zimbabwe cannot live in the past. We have to move forward. So those youths are misdirected. What we expect from a knowledgeable group of youth is to demand that he resigns forthwith, so that other able-bodied Zimbabweans can take over.
Two ruling party factions, one allegedly led by Mnangagwa and another by First Lady Grace Mugabe, are said to be fighting over the succession of Mr. Mugabe. Reporting for Studio 7 in Mutare, this is Lloyd Moyo.
A record company and DJ collective based in Germany is breathing new life into rare African vinyl records from the 1960s and 70s. In many cases, the records have never been released outside of their countries of origin and have often been forgotten, sometimes even by the artists themselves. So Gino Rusbler has more on Analog Africa from Amsterdam.
Gone but not forgotten. Under that credo, Tunisian-German Semi Ben Rajib started his record label Analog Africa 10 years ago. He focused on funk, disco and Afrobeat, like this song by Congolese artist Ferkis. What he found was a stark contrast to the modern-day music coming out of Africa.
The music that was filtering here was generally music that was very often recorded in Europe. So it was music that was recorded in European studios with European producers. And I believe that that's what also triggered the world music. And it's a kind of music that was basically created to suit and to fit Western ears. It was not gritty, it didn't have that raw energy that... because it was music that was done, polished for the European market.
Ben Rajib doesn't just dig up and re-releases dusty old records, he curates the music.
I spend a great amount of time going through collections of records, and then I listen to the stuff I found on a particular country, for example, and I listen and I record them on a mini disc. I erase the song that I don't like. I shuffled the song to find a good running order. This is a process that takes years. And then once I have the selection, I go back to the country. I try to find the musicians, but I always try to get to the source of the song.
Once that process is done, the DJ licenses the song, writes down the history of the song, and collects as many pictures as he can from the era.
Analog Africa isn't trying to create a comprehensive archive. Ben Rajib chooses songs because he likes them, like the classics from Orchestre Polyritmo de Continu from Benin.
There were fans of like James Brown, Johnny Holiday from France, Nana Mouskouri. They would take that stuff, then try to do something that is similar. Very often, like the bass was very often based on the way Benin, traditional Benin music is played, and then they did the funk on top.
Since its inception, Analog Africa has re-released 24 final records. The label also makes the songs available for download on its website. Serginho Rosblad for VOA News, Amsterdam.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. The continent is in mourning after Nigeria's 2013 Coach of the Year, Stephen Keshi, passed away following a suspected heart attack in Benin City, Edo State, South Nigeria. His brother and manager, Emmanuel Addo, broke the sad news to the world on Wednesday. In his prime, Keshi was captain of the Nigeria Super Eagles when they won the 1996 Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Tunisia. Later, besides coaching Mali, he guided Togo to qualify for their maiden appearance at the FIFA World Cup in 2006. As head coach, Keshi guided the Nigeria Super Eagles to win the Nations Cup again in South Africa in 2013. Keshi's wife, Kate, succumbed to cancer last year, and his brother Addo says Keshi may not have fully recovered from the loss of his wife for 35 years. On a more cheerful note, in athletics, Algerian Olympic 1500-meter champion Taufik Makloufi will challenge Kenyan middle-distance dominance at the IAAF Diamond League in Oslo, Norway today, Thursday. Makloufi's main opponents in the one-mile race are multiple world 1500-meter champion Asbel Kiprop and world championship silver medalist Elijah Manangoi. In women's one-mile, Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon faces Ethiopian Aksumawit Embai. Kenyan world champion Hyvin Yang and Ethiopian Olympic bronze medalist Sofia Assefa clash in women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. On form, Ethiopians Mukhtar Edris, World Championship silver medalist Yomif Kejelcha, and Hagos Gebrehiwet face off with Moroccan Abdelati Igida and Kenyan Olympic bronze medalist Thomas Longisiwa in 5,000 meters. Kenyan world champion Nicholas Bett contests the 400-meter hurdles as Ivory Coast's Winfred Kofi is entered for the 100 meters. On the infield, Kenyan world champion Julius Yego and Egypt's world championship silver medalist Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayel go head-to-head in javelin as South African Godfrey Kotso Mokwena contests the triple jump. In volleyball, Kenya play Puerto Rico at the World Women's Volleyball Grand Prix Group 2 in Flokawek, Poland tomorrow, Friday. Elsewhere in Group 3, Algeria face hosts Peru in Chiclayo on Saturday. On Sunday, Kenya challenge hosts Poland, while Algeria encounter Croatia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A Nigerian rebel group has rejected the government's offer of talks to end pipeline attacks that are disrupting the country's oil production. And that's it for this Thursday, June 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckfer, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Marco Ouma, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we will discuss African Liberation Day. Tune into Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC to join host Shaka Saleh and his panels of guests.